We all must eat to live, and so think little about the daily task of hunting down food, processing it into something edible, and then cooking it up into a meal. It's what we must do, day in, day out, for all of the days of our life. But then something happens to some of us, and the entire process of eating to live becomes one of living to eat. This transformation leads us to ask, can one become a foodie without going belly up?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the, what is it, the 776th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Quebec City who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Easton Allen on the board. Hello, Easton.
Hello, Michael.
And a big congratulations, folks. Easton is leaving us. He's heading off, going to the big stick down in market number 2, Los Angeles. Good luck to you, Easton.
Thank you, Michael.
Folks, after hosting 776 editions of this Food Chain radio show and writing in the textbook about metropolitan agriculture and consulting with farmers around the world, I reckon it's time for me to fess up and admit, I guess I am a foodie. Now, being a foodie doesn't necessarily restrict one to refined taste and a fascination with good food. That would just make one a mere gourmet. Now, foodies not only love to eat good food, but we also love to study and talk about the people, the politics, and technologies of food. Food must feed our intellect as well as our body. Thus, for the foodie, the day-to-day process of hunting down food, processing it into something edible, and then cooking it up into a meal can become like a daily pilgrimage to the Holy Land that just might eat up all of one's time and money. So this foodie fanaticism that sometimes get to us leads us to ask today, can one become a foodie without going belly up? And today we have somebody really fun to help us cook up some thoughts on this. Daniel Duane, author of How to Cook Like a Man. Daniel, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you're a graduate of UC Santa Cruz, and I am as well, and so many people that go through that university end up being foodies. Do you have any idea why that is?
Well, it must have to do with the magnificent food in the area.
That might have something.
Yeah, all the great, you know, all the incredible farms, the berry farms, all that, the killer tomatoes.
But you weren't a foodie when you were a UC student. You were a surfer.
I was a surfer and a burrito eater, pretty much. With
right.
Occasional forays into tomato with red sauce and maybe the odd stir fry. Yeah.
The surfer burrito. You might fill us in a little bit on what the ultimate surfer burrito is.
Well, there's a, the ultimate surfer burrito is mostly just big, but
redwood sized, right?
Yeah, super, super carne asada. But it was usually, I could usually tell when a surf session was when the meter was running on a surf session, when a vision of a burrito would sort of suddenly appear in front of me. I'd be sitting there on my board out there in the cold water, and all of a sudden this beautiful golden burrito would start floating in front of me, and I thought, the blood sugar's getting low. It's time to go in.
It works like that. Just out of curiosity, what did you study?
Well, I went to Santa Cruz. I went to UC Santa Cruz for graduate school, so
got
a PhD in American literature there, thinking that I would become a college professor, but I didn't.
Uh-huh. I studied English and Chinese literature there. And so somehow I became a foodie, and I'm still trying to scratch my head. Originally, I think I was starting off to be an astronaut, but somehow I ended up as a foodie. And I just say, I blame it on UC Santa Cruz. I don't know what it was about the place.
Yeah, I think UC Santa Cruz doesn't produce a lot of actual astronauts. I think it probably produces a lot of metaphorical astronauts.
I think it produced Sally Ride.
Santa. Oh, did it really?
Yeah.
Did she go to UC Santa Cruz?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm wrong.
So there you go. Well, let's go to your book, How to Cook Like a Man. Now, being a Montana boy, when I hear somebody say something like, how to cook like a man, I think of roasting a buffalo hump over an open fire under the prairie skies. What do you mean by how to cook like a man?
Well, I guess, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot because the title just kind of came to me one day and it felt right. And this is not, my book is not a cookbook, of course, and it's not, there isn't a single recipe in it. And it's not a guide to buffalo rump under the open sky cooking, although there is a lot of carnivorousness in it. But
it kind of really gets to the heart of what it is to be a foodie, though, doesn't it? It's not the recipes.
I guess that's right. And I think what the title meant to me was, partly it was a wink-wink kind of joking title because an awful lot of what I do in that book is not, what I describe doing is not very manly. But there's another way in which I had gotten married and had a kid, and it was time for me to become an adult man in that sense. You know, I had been a surfer, mostly concerned with getting good waves and eating burritos for a long time. And all of a sudden, I had to kind of grow up. And
you had a responsibility.
Yeah, I had to deal with responsibility. I had to be a man in that sense. And cooking was a big part of how I got there.
So what you're suggesting is that to become a man, you became the family cook.
That's exactly what I'm suggesting. Yeah, that's right. That's how it worked.
Tell us about that transition there. That must have been an interesting one. Did you like, your wife like surfer burritos?
Well, my wife, you know, she didn't mind the surfer burritos. When we met, about the time we met, I had this practice of keeping in my fridge at all times, recycled yogurt containers holding black beans, another one holding brown rice, another one holding guacamole, which I would make, and another one holding the basic salsa. And then I would always have large whole wheat burritos on hand. And this was so that I could deliver a 1,000-calorie burrito to my mouth in about 5 minutes, any time, day or night, 24 hours. And, the funny thing about my wife is she grew up in a fancy food family. Her grandfather had been a chef, actually. But she was
not only was a chef, but he was a chef that invented a very famous sandwich, right?
That's right. My wife's father invented the Reuben sandwich. For real.
For real. And was a chef of very famous at a very actually the proprietor of some very famous hotels at a time when hotels actually had very fancy restaurants and were actually destination resorts and whatnot.
Yeah, that's right. They had the this chain of hotels is now gone, but her family had a chain of hotels called the Schimmel Hotels across the sort of along the rail lines of the Midwest in the old days when businessmen traveled across the East and the Midwest by rail. And these little regional hotels were a very important part of business travel in those days.
And then your wife, of course, grew up in that milieu and then runs across a surfer who likes burritos and you get in a family way. And then how did you make that transition from being a burrito chef to being to actually thinking about what you're preparing for dinner that night?
Well, okay, so my wife does the same kind of work I do. We're both freelance writers. So we both work at home. So all day we're doing the same thing, right? And we're doing it for the same amount of pay, more or less. And the same number of hours, and we're both equally beat at the end of the day. So now you add a newborn baby to that mix, and all of a sudden, every evening, somebody's got to wrangle the baby, somebody's got to get dinner on the table, and I don't really have much of a case to be made that my wife should do both so I can drink a beer on the couch, as much as I might like that. So
that would not be the kind of man that would cook, would it? That would be a good cook, the kind that would come home and sit there with a beer while the spouse does the work.
Yeah, that's right. And so I looked at this choice between diapers, really, and knives, you know, and that wasn't so hard for me. But then, pretty quickly, if I'm making dinner every night, you know, one gets tired of one's burritos and, you know, tomato with red sauce every single night. You start scratching your head thinking, I got to broaden my repertoire.
From burritos and pasta with tomato sauce, we got to figure out somewhere else to go in life. So what was your first step?
So I had this funny biographical quirk, which is that the chef Alice Waters had been my Montessori preschool teacher in Berkeley.
Ooh, Alice Waters. Now we're getting into very deep water.
Yeah, and as a result, when I thought, well, I got to just, you know, and I, as a result, I had a couple of her cookbooks around, you know, because I was like...
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, Duane, but when we come back, one of the most fascinating stories you told me about Alice Waters was how she started her business because she got fired from being a school teacher for wearing blouses that were too revealing. Now, that is interesting marketing. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here. Today, we're talking about becoming a foodie and what it means to be a foodie, and above all, what it is to prepare meals for the family, and hey, how to cook like a man. Michael Olson with Daniel Duane, and you right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, folks, we're talking about making a big... There you go. I think I have you still, Duane, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I hit the button on the new console here, and it took a ride on me. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about making this wonderful transition from surfer burritos to home cooking for the family. And the key was a gal named Alice Waters. Now, Alice was a very famous gal who is kind of like the goddess of foodieism here on the West Coast. Take it away, Duane. How did you begin to follow Alice Waters?
Well, move number one in expanding my repertoire, right, well, my sort of creating a repertoire beyond my two dishes, was to look through the cookbooks I had. I happened to have a book called Chapinese Vegetables by Alice Waters. Now, I'm a carnivorous guy. I wasn't particularly concerned one way or another with whether I was cooking a lot of vegetables, but it was a book I happened to have. I'm looking through this book, and I'm thinking, there must be 350 recipes in here. Why is it that the only one I ever cook is the one for tomato with red sauce, with pasta with red sauce, which I already know how to make? And it occurs to me, I look through this book, and I think to myself, well, let's see, turnip and turnip green soup. Gee, you know, I don't even really know what a turnip is. Yeah, that must be gross. I shouldn't make that. And then it sort of occurs to me, well, that's kind of dumb. Like, that's sort of like the kid, you know, the three-year-old thinking, yeah, I don't know about this chocolate-covered bacon stuff Mom's trying to give me. I mean, that's probably rat poison. Yeah, no thanks, Mom. No chocolate-covered bacon for me. And it's the fear of the unfamiliar. So then I decided, well, I guess I should just do that Julie and Julia thing and cook every recipe in this book, which I did. 350 recipes. Now, this book is A to Z by vegetable, with about five dishes per vegetable. And it covers just about every plant food you're likely ever to see at a farmer's market, at least a farmer's market in my part of the country. So a couple of years later, hey, I had played around with just about everything every plant food in every market in town. And that was a good way to get going.
And what did your wife think about that? Great experimentation.
Well, that was a little surprising to me. I had thought she would be thrilled, mostly because she does prefer to eat more vegetables than animals. And here I was making all these great soups and salads and using all these great vegetables. But for one thing, she was either breastfeeding or pregnant or breastfeeding again for pretty much the entire period I was working on that book and the book after it. And so her appetite was a little fickle. And also, I wasn't so concerned in those years with, I hadn't yet learned to think of cooking as something you're doing for other people. In other words, I was, I've come a long way since then, but I was thinking of it more as, well, in that kind of male obsessive way, you know, I went, oh, well, tonight's, you know, it's potato night. I got to tick off all five of the potato recipes, you know, so we'd have a dinner that was basically potatoes five ways, you know, and the whole kitchen's a mess and I've made five different dishes and my wife's just kind of scratching her head like, okay, so we're going to have homemade potato chips, you know, roasted potatoes. We're going to have a potato gratin. All right. I guess this is dinner.
But she was probably thinking about the good old days of the surfer burritos by then, right?
Well, I think she was. You know, 5 minutes, burrito, done, and I'd be in there helping her with the diapers instead of, you know, an hour and a half on potatoes, making a mess, and then pulling the old, you cook, you know, I cook, you clean.
There you go. Now, take us back to Alice Waters and how you came to follow her or track her or go with her.
Well, so, like I said, she had been my Montessori preschool teacher just when I was a little kid for a year. Growing up in Berkeley, where I grew up, you know, that was one of those biographical details that, you know, let's say you grew up in the ranch next to George Bush's in Crawford, Texas. You know, your family would never let you forget it, right? Your parents would always be, you grew up next to, you know. So in the culture of my town, that was just, you know, one of those close brushes with, she was our local famous person, and I had some connection. So I started cooking from that first book of hers. Well, then I liked it so much, I thought, well, I'll just cook from another one of hers, and then another one. So I did fruit next, and then it was pizza, pasta, calzone, I think. And then I was just kind of off and running, and I ended up cooking from all eight cookbooks that she had in print at that time. She has since published one or two more.
Well, you later came to know Alice Waters and Shape and Eat pretty well. I mean, and started to writing about her. Tell us a little bit about her. Why is she so famous? What is it about that restaurant, and how did she come to get into the restaurant business in the first place? Which may be the best story of all.
Yeah, right. So the way Alice told the story to me, I eventually did some writing for her, which is how I met her. I helped her write a book about her edible schoolyard project, which is a project of gardens in the schools. And while I was working for her there, and I you know, it was sort of early in the process, I told her, hey, do you know that I was in your Montessori class way back when? And she said, she laughed and told me she'd gotten fired from that job for wearing sheer blouses too many days in a row, and some parents started to complain. And I got to figure, if parents were complaining enough to get you fired in 1970 in Berkeley, California, they must have been some pretty sheer blouses.
Must have been sheer. Well, I got to thinking about that, and I always thought Alice Waters to be one of the most clever marketing persons in the world, and your story convinced me that I was right. That's pretty good stuff. So she went into restaurateuring, but what is it about that restaurant of hers that is so special? It's always in one of the top 50 restaurants in the world, but why?
Well, so Shape and Ease was really the first place that I know of in the United States. I guess there are people who dispute this a little bit, but famously early to Alice had eaten a lot in Alice had fallen in love with food in France as a young woman. When she came back to the States after this, and particularly when she started trying to open her restaurant as a young woman, she knew she would never be able to replicate the food she had tasted in France without ingredients of the quality she had eaten in France. So, you know, beautiful produce in season, you know, all sorts of fruits and vegetables in season, meats from local ranchers who were taking good care of their animals, that kind of thing. And in early 1970s California, none of that stuff was available readily in the supermarkets. most of the, you know, most of the produce and the meats were really pretty mass produced and homogeneous, and tomatoes at all season and, you know, all times of year. So Alice was a pioneer in sort of driving the backwoods and country byways of Northern California, looking for farmers who could grow, looking for farmers who were growing the kinds of fruits and vegetables she wanted in small batches with care, to deliver the highest quality fruits and vegetables possible. Then she was all, this is, you know, the funny thing about all this is it's like hearing that Jimi Hendrix was, you know, a pioneer in putting distortion on his guitar, and you sort of think, well, that's interesting. Everybody does that now. You know, what she did is so commonplace now that it's almost hard to realize how unusual it was at the time. But she started then insisting that the restaurant, you know, would only serve tomatoes in tomato season. That means there's no tomatoes in the restaurant except in sort of late August, September, early October.
Which is almost like sacrilege, not having a tomato in January. Wow.
And the idea was that when you did show up in late August, early September, and you finally got a tomato, it would be the best tomato you'd ever had in your life because it was at the peak of ripeness. So she taught us all a lot about the power of beautiful, you know, carefully raised fruits and vegetables eaten at the peak of ripeness, at the peak of season, to make healthy foods more exciting.
But she also had a way of bringing the right people into her restaurant that would spread the word of this new kind of old cooking, right?
Yeah, she did. So Alice is herself a very good cook, but she has never really been the head chef at Chez Panisse. She is in many ways better thought of as what they call a restaurateur or restauratrice. She's been the manager and dreamer.
Can you hold that thought? We have to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking foodieism with the guy who wrote the book, How to Cook Like a Man, Daniel Duane. And you're invited to participate. You want to talk about foodieism? 831-479-1080. Right back. We're talking Chez Panisse. Well, folks, we all must eat to live, and so think little about the daily task of hunting down food, processing it into something edible, and then cooking it up into a meal. It's what we must do day in, day out for all of our days. But then something happens to some of us, and the entire process of eating to live becomes one of living to eat. And I suppose that happened to Alice Waters someplace along the line, and she decided to open a restaurant and change the way people ate at her restaurant. But not only did she do that, she changed the way most of the country thinks about its food. And how on earth did she make that be one of the people on the forefront of that great change? And that's what we're talking about with Daniel Duane, who is the author of How to Cook Like a Man. Gosh, she did change things, but when we left off, we were talking about how she was really smart about being a restaurant entrepreneur and building a wonderful audience. And I don't know if restaurateurs think of their patrons as an audience, but surely she must have.
Well, I suppose that's right. You know, Alice had a gift for bringing in remarkably talented young chefs, for one thing. You know, her Chez Panisse was for many years almost like a graduate school through which many, if not most, of the nation's most talented chefs would pass at some point, get their ticket punched, and go off to open great restaurants all over the country, from the South to the Southwest. You know, some of the most signature restaurants in many different regions of this country were started by Chez Panisse alumni.
And also its patrons were notable people, too.
So Alice Berkeley was a place of a lot of political and social upheaval, obviously, in the 70s when she opened Chez Panisse. And she ran with a pretty tony crowd. In the early days, Chez Panisse was filled with filmmakers and political radicals and writers and various intellectuals and artists. And that's right.
And I wonder often about the impact of food critics in taking something like Chez Panisse, this whole concept of local food, I guess, and then taking it to the world. What are some of the, you write a little bit about James Beard. Tell us about James Beard.
So James Beard was the great American food critic and food writer of that period. He was more than a food critic, obviously. He also wrote a lot of enormously influential cookbooks. In some ways, you know, he may have been the most, he was certainly the most influential food writer of his period. So let's think of that as the mid 20th century. And he came to, James Beard came to Chez Panisse in the mid 70s. And it was James Beard who really put the place on the national map. It was James Beard who told the whole country in his syndicated food columns that something special was happening in Berkeley.
So there it was. You talk a lot about the impact of these cookbooks on your life. When you picked up these books and actually read the recipes and followed them, do you follow those recipes by the letter?
Well, I did. I certainly did for a long time. I guess I don't quite so much anymore. But for many years I felt that I had so little intuition or taste of my own around food that I just had, you know, if it said a teaspoon and a half, I used a teaspoon and a half. And if it said, you know, if it said you had to have this kind of lettuce instead of that kind of lettuce, I was going to drive all over town until I found the right kind of lettuce.
But when I look at a cookbook, and I get a lot of cookbooks, people send me a lot of cookbooks because I do a radio show about food. They consequently think I'm talking about recipes all the time, but what I like to do is read the stuff between and for and after the recipes, because I learn so much about food that way. Because these are people who write these books, like James Beard, are not just gourmets in a sense, but they're really foodies. And they're people who are interested in everything else about food as well. Did you find that to be true?
I did. I mean, certainly from Alice's books, I absorbed the whole, you know, she has a pretty clear philosophy of how one ought to live and eat, you know, and there I picked up other bits of, you know, almost kind of life philosophy from other cookbooks later on down the line. But from Alice, it was that this very clear vision she has, you know, that the way to be healthy and enjoy life, you know, around food anyway, is to shop at the farmer's market in your area and buy whatever looks beautiful and take it home and cook it simply. Don't get in the way of it.
Now, when you first started working with food, is that what you did? Did you go to the farmer's market? What was your experience there?
Well, so there's this farmer's market here in San Francisco.
A famous one.
At the ferry building here. There's a ferry terminal down by the water, down along the bay there. And, boy, you know, it's a pretty overwhelming experience. It's a great thing for, you know, for anyone who's ever in town here as a tourist. It's one of the Saturday morning market there is one of the great sights, because all these restaurants come and set up booths, some terrific restaurants, and some of the finest farmers in, you know, in California, some of the best, you know, sort of boutique organic farms that are selling their produce to the very top restaurants in the country are, you know, they all show up and you can shake the farmer's hand. You can buy this exact same zucchini that they're going to be using that very night at the Three Michelin Star place, you know, down the street. And
real food with its farmer's face on it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I found it thrilling, but almost sort of too thrilling. I'd walk in there and, well, partly because I had Alice's book, her book Vegetables back in the early days as my kind of, you know, my, I don't know what you want to call it, my foodie Bible or something, with all the list of all these foods. There were all these vegetables in there that you'll never find at your garden variety supermarket. You'll never even see them at a supermarket. Like the one I said before, turnips with turnip greens. I mean, when at a normal supermarket have you ever seen baby turnips with their greens still attached? And I'd walk into the ferry plaza farmer's market, look, oh my God, there's all, you know, there's the turnips with the turnip greens. I can make that recipe. Or even weirder stuff like cardoons. You know, whoever heard of cardoons? And all of a sudden, oh my God, this guy's got cardoons. I can make all five cardoon recipes tonight.
Thus, the surfer who specialized in surf burritos is cooking cardoon souffles. Quite a transition. You know, one of the fun things that you talk about was your your foray into meats and cooking meats? How did that start?
So that all started with a book by Michael Pollan that was a national bestseller called The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes a very, you know, the takeaway message I got from that book was that his descriptions of confined animal feeding operations are so upsetting. These are the sort of feedlot production of industrial meats that so on the one hand, that was so upsetting, but then his description of of livestock management done sort of the traditional old school way, which is the way it's still done on a lot of farms in this country, was so winning and so positive that this book just kind of, I guess you could say I'm an impressionable fellow. So that book hit me like a thunderbolt and made me feel sort of, on the one hand, I need to be, when it comes to sort of commodity supermarket feedlot beef, it's time for me to become a vegetarian. But when it comes to properly raised
foods
and the like.
And the ultimate of that, of course, would be the A5 Kobe beef. So when we come back from this break, we're going to have Daniel DeWayne, author of How to Cook Like a Man, take us on a tour of steaks in Las Vegas, and we'll discover the A5. Oh, my God, hold on to your fork. Well, folks, way back when... Ooh, looks like we lost him here or something happened. I don't know. I guess we lost our guest. You might pick him up. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson here. We're at Food Chain Radio number 776. We're talking about the foodies. And have you ever been I'm sure you're a foodie of some sort. We all are. I mean, we all must eat every day, but sometimes it's nice to really taste our food. And it happened to be once I was in Japan. Let's see, we're tweaking the phones here. I don't know, it says he's there. And okay, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Talk about foodies with Daniel DeWayne. We're working on bringing him back on the phone. He's somewhere out there in the universe, and we're going to try to pick him up here. And what I'll do is click a couple buttons and maybe help us out here. So I was going to talk with Daniel about his foray into eating steaks in Las Vegas. He had told a wonderful story about going there and eating some of the world's best steaks in the best steakhouses. I wanted to ask him about, of course, Kobe beef and what made Kobe beef so incredibly special. I had the opportunity to taste it once myself in Tokyo, at a wonderful meal put on for me by a bunch of people that I don't know why they did, but I just found myself in this place, and there I was. And just had this absolutely wonderful experience with a meat that was so incredibly tender and flavorful that you wouldn't think of eating it with a knife and a fork, that you just broke it apart with your chopsticks, and you put it in your mouth, and it just kind of melted into your mouth. And so that's what we were going to play with today. And we're picking up with Daniel DeWayne, who wrote this wonderful book, How to Cook Like a Man. And the story was really fun because Daniel started off as a surfer specializing in surf burritos and then ended up as a genuine foodie. Daniel, we have you back?
Yeah.
Hey, good. I must have punched another button here or something, but you just disappeared and now you're back. We're talking about your foray into eating steaks in Las Vegas. Why Las Vegas?
Well, you know, Las Vegas, as a lot of people may know now, has, against all odds, you might say, become sort of a culinary capital of the Western world. Just about every celebrity chef imaginable these days has a restaurant in one of the Vegas casinos, and a lot of them, not just celebrity chefs, but sort of superstar, you know, fine dining gourmet chefs from France, and they all have these very high-end restaurants, which means there's an awful lot of culinary genius focused on that town.
Placed in one little place, yeah, so you can really get in on some food. So you decided to go on a steak for, why steaks? What was the...
Well, it occurred to, so then looking at all these restaurants online one day, I noticed that they all have big steaks. In fact, half of these restaurants are steakhouses. Mario Batali, for example, has what he calls an Italian steakhouse in Las Vegas, which is sort of hilarious. But even the guys who aren't calling their restaurants steakhouses are offering huge, beautiful steaks at, and these are very expensive steaks, which sort of led my, you know, when you start thinking about it, you realize, God, you know, it kind of looks like Las Vegas right now is the scene of perhaps the world's greatest ever kind of steak cookery death match, you know, with all this money, all these genius chefs concentrating all this time and energy on kind of a steak arms race, seeing who can make the steak worth the highest price tag. And these are not cheap steaks. So that's why.
And the highest price tag, of course, would be the Kobe beef, the A5
yeah.
Kobe. Tell us about Kobe beef.
Well,
kind of seems like it's the apogee of foodieism, right?
It's the apogee of a certain kind of foodieism anyway. So A5, Kobe beef is, the sort of quick, Kobe is a town and a region of Japan. So the sort of simplest way to think about it is that it's beef from that part of Japan. But that part of Japan and is famous, for raising beef in a very particular way. A lot of how the beef is raised is actually shrouded in secrecy. They don't really let outsiders in to take a good look at it. But the product is the most richly marbled beef you've ever seen in your life. I mean, when you look at a cross section of a A5 Kobe ribeye, next to even a USDA prime ribeye, I mean, they are so beautifully marbled with fat. You kind of find yourself looking for where the meat is to try to find the pink parts.
I remember having a taste of Kobe beef at a restaurant in Tokyo, and how it just literally melted in my mouth.
Yeah. There's something about when that stuff touches your tongue. You sure don't need very much of it. Although I did end up eating an awful lot. But
I guess the person who seemed to have foodieism down to a science or down to perfection would be Thomas Keller.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about your experiences with Thomas Keller. Oh,
well,
shucks, there goes the music. We'll have to pick it up when we come back. There's two things I wanted to ask you. What made Thomas Keller have such a big impact on American foodieism? And the last question I'd like to ask you, Daniel Duane, as author of How to Cook Like a Man, I would like to ask you, what would you like to have for your last supper? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. We have a few minutes left and so much to talk about with Daniel Duane. Our phone numbers, if you'd like to jump aboard today, 831-479-1080. And the big question on the table is a question that is often talked across the table between chefs. What would you like to have for your last supper? We will be right back. Hey, we're back. A few minutes to go. A lot to talk about. A couple of my favorite things, though. Thomas Keller, the proprietor of the French Laundry in Napa. Oh, my goodness. Talk about a mouth-watering location to have a dinner. And you actually cooked with him, Daniel Duane. Tell us briefly about why you really zeroed in on Thomas Keller.
Well, I zeroed in, I guess, because I had... I got a book of his that was a bestseller a couple of years ago called Ad Hoc at Home. Now, Thomas Keller is famous for, the fanciest of the fancy fine dining white tablecloth eateries, but he has another restaurant called Ad Hoc. It's where the food is served family style. In other words, it's a great place. It's in Yountville, California. You sit down around the table. There's no ordering. There's no menu. They just have one fixed menu per night. And it comes out on big platters, the salad comes out in a salad bowl with tongs and that kind of thing. I got this cookbook, I started cooking from it, and it was filled with these very interesting little bits of wisdom and tips and lessons about how to organize your kitchen, how to organize your workflow in your kitchen, the importance of cleanliness. And this stuff really resonated for me.
Tell me about your description of his cleanliness. Really struck me because I'm a clean freak, I guess. Tell us a little bit how he cleans everything. It's a fun story.
Well, he is famous for an obsession with cleanliness and tidiness in the kitchen, and this is something that chefs who've worked there and sous chefs and cooks, you know, and who worked under him have been observing for years. And the feeling is that he famously sort of starts after every little preparation, he'll clean his entire workspace as if he's done for the day. And then he'll start another preparation and then clean the entire workspace and start another preparation. I mean, the idea is to be constantly removing anything that could be an obstacle. You know, let's say you...
Or a distraction.
Anything that could interrupt your workflow. That's right.
And totally focus on what you're doing at hand.
Yeah.
And you actually worked with him both in California and in New York City, and as per se in New York City.
Right. So I got... This was sort of one of, you know, life's sort of unexpected little miracles. I was doing a magazine story called Five Meals Every Man Should Master, and it was a pretty simple, straightforward idea. The idea was, what if we come up with five dishes that if a guy, or five meals, complete meals, that if a guy gets these mastered, he's set for every key occasion in life. You know, the poker night with the buddies, the having the in-laws over, Sunday family dinner, you know, sort of key moves. Well, we went looking for a chef to do this with, and I was cooking from Keller's cookbooks at the time, so I just took a wild long shot and reached out to his people, and holy smokes, he said yes. Not only did he say yes, he gave very generously of his time.
Lucky you. Listen, we have just about a minute left, and one of the great parlor games chefs play when they're together is, what meal would you like for your last one? So I'll ask you that, Daniel Duane, author of How to Cook Like a Man. What meal would you take for your last meal?
Well, I think it would have to be the one I made last night, which was for the whole family. I made New York steaks, you know, seared in a cast iron skillet and basted with butter, garlic, and rosemary, and finished with a nice big fat dollop of a compound butter, you know, butter mixed with garlic and parsley. So it was just that butter melting over the steak.
And then, of course, the most important ingredient of all, the family.
The family.
Thank you very much, Daniel Duane, author How to Cook Like a Man. Thank you all out there for tuning in The Food Chain. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.